Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, editor-at-large at The Hub. I'm honored to be joined today by Coleman Hughes, a political analyst for CNN, contributing writer at the Free Press, and one of today's most interesting commentators on issues of race, public policy, and ethics. He's also the author of the must-read new book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. I'm grateful to speak with him about the book, including the rise and subsequent decline of the principle of colorblindness in American society, and why and how he believes it should be restored. Coleman, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues, and congratulations on the book.
My pleasure to be here.
I suppose we ought to start with colorblindness itself. You describe it as the goal of treating people without regard to race and outline a pretty comprehensive history of its place in the civil rights movement, including represented in the ideals of Dr. Martin Luther King. Talk about colorblindness, Coleman. What is it? What isn't it? What's its historic role in influencing the vision of many of American history's most important civil rights champions?
Yeah, so many people have equated colorblindness to pretending not to see race, or using a phrase like, I don't see race. I think that that's the wrong way to look at colorblindness because, as a matter of fact, we do see race. Certainly adults in the Western world at this point see race, right? We're on Zoom right now and you can see that I'm not white and I'm not Asian, right? And I can see your race to the extent that I guess it correctly. And furthermore, we're all capable of being racially biased. So that's not the kind of colorblindness I want. The kind of colorblindness I want is to try your very best to treat people without regard to race. That's a conscious effort. And also to demand of our public policy, of our laws, of the policies we use to benefit the disadvantaged, to demand of those policies that they do not treat us differently on the basis of race. And there's been a very effective campaign within certain parts of academia, critical race scholars, for instance, to paint colorblindness as a conservative idea, as an idea associated with backlash to the civil rights movement. So in chapter two of my book, which is called the chapter title, The Real History of Colorblindness, I go all the way back to the 1860s to a man named Wendell Phillips, who was one of the most important abolitionists in the country. He had the nickname Abolition's Golden Trumpet. And he was the first person that I'm aware of to use the word colorblind in the context of advocating for a 14th Amendment that would make the, in his words, that would make the government colorblind, right? So that's the origins of colorblindness is not with conservatives or reactionaries, but actually with the most radical wing of the abolition movement. And from there, you get a through line to the civil rights movement to a point where colorblindness is close to enshrined in this Civil Rights Act of 1964.
You write that colorblindness seems to have come under a renewed attack beginning in about 2014. What happened? What do you think explains the growing challenge to the principles of colorblindness in universities, politics, and the broader culture?
So the background climate is that starting in the 70s and 80s, you get an intellectual movement, critical race theory, which defines itself in opposition to colorblindness, comes up with a whole set of writing and a whole set of ideas wherein colorblindness is actually white supremacy in disguise. Now, that remains a very marginal thing. It's basically, you're only aware of that if you're at certain law schools, at certain departments of certain elite colleges. 99% of people are completely unaware and uninfluenced by that philosophy. Until you get to 2013, where essentially what happens is race relations in America got better and better and better throughout the 2000s. Every year, pretty much every year of Bush's and early Obama's presidencies, you get more and more Black, white, and Hispanic Americans saying that race relations are good. In fact, a majority of all races say that in 2013. Then 2013 comes around and everything starts to decline. And the reason for that is that's when everyone got smartphones and social media. So now you have a situation in which people are filming random events and upsetting events having to do with race. It could be a police officer arresting a Black suspect, for instance, get promoted preferentially in your social media timeline, go viral without any additional journalistic context surrounding them. And people begin to have the false impression that racism is at an all-time high. And that makes the ground fertile for this kind of philosophy that has been marginal for decades in critical race theory and so forth. It creates an opening for that because people are saying, wow, actually racism is everywhere. It's showing up all over my Facebook timeline. Maybe these critical race folks are correct. And that basically a kind of memeified form of critical race theory goes viral. And it was really called wokeness or social justice. And that's essentially what happens.
I want to take up the underlying ideas and ideologies that you just outlined there, Coleman. You characterize contemporary critics of colorblindness as the, quote, neo-racists. And you don't pull any punches here. You describe them and their intellectual and political movement as, quote, racist, destructive, and contrary to the civil rights movement in which, quote, skin color is given supreme importance, unquote. Who are the neo-racists? What, in broad terms, is their argument? And perhaps most importantly, how have they come to hold influence over key institutions in our society?
Yeah, so in my book, I talk about neo-racism as the philosophy which says, in a nutshell, whiteness is evil. White people cannot be discriminated against, even in principle, and which seeks to essentially enshrine racial discrimination at the level of public policy as a positive good, and which also essentially stereotypes white people as kind of evil colonizers and stereotypes Black people as sort of helpless victims. And I give example after example of this in the book. I go particularly hard after Robin DiAngelo because she's the, I think, you know, the kind of most ultra best-selling version of this philosophy. She says, for instance, that white women shouldn't cry around Black people because it reminds us Black people of when white women used to do that. And in the Jim Crow context, that would get Black boys lynched for rapes they didn't commit. I've never personally seen that ever happen with any Black person I know, that they saw a white woman crying and got triggered essentially to the traumatic history of lynchings. It's not actually something that ever happens. It's made up. But in her world, it's important enough to include in a book to teach people, sort of, to teach white people sort of how to behave around Black people. This is not a basis for a healthy relationship between members of different races. This is essentially the relationship between a parent and an exasperated parent and a child. So that's one element of neo-racism. The other is trying to enshrine racial discrimination at the level of policy. And that's something that Ibram Kendi has been at the forefront of. My argument in the book is that we should instead base policies on socioeconomic class, because that's actually a better proxy for disadvantage. And then the question of how did neo-racism become enshrined in our elite institutions? I mean, I think that it's sort of the same story that I had just laid out about what happened starting around 2013, that this softened the ground for many people at elite institutions to receive these kind of ideas. And the idea was that if racism is everywhere, then every institution needs to be fighting it. And the only script given to fight it was the neo-racist Kendi and DiAngelo script.
Coleman, you used the word woke in a previous answer, but I observed that it doesn't appear anywhere in the book. Why not? What is wrong in your mind with the description of woke or wokeism or whatever one uses?
So I intentionally didn't use it because I think as a writer, words that get overused, it's sort of like, I forget what, there's actually a term for the phenomenon, but if you say a word enough times, it can stop sounding like a word, right? There's something similar that happens with a word like woke or social justice, where that it gets used so much that it sort of just goes in one ear and out the other. You don't actually process the meaning of the word. I think this also happens with metaphors and idioms that are used too often. So just as a matter of good writing, I wanted to come up with a different word and a more precise word, I think. A word that actually has a kind of distinct meaning and lands in a particular way. So that's why I chose neo-racism, because the philosophy is racist, right? It is racist according to the definition of racism used by the civil rights leaders of the past. And so it's more precise and it lands in a way that I think wokeness doesn't.
To that point, as you thought about neo-racism in a broader historical context, how did you come to think about its similarities and differences with the racism of the past? You write, for instance, that both, quote, deny our common humanity, unquote. Elaborate, Coleman, on that particular insight and others that the book sets out about neo-racism and its historical antecedents.
Yeah. So if you or I were to say something like, there's only one race, the human race, there are only two groups of people that are going to tell you you're wrong. One is going to be white supremacists who are going to say, actually, you know, there's the white race and there's everybody else, you know, not to stereotype how my people may sound, but the hardcore white racists are going to disagree with that for the reasons that we know that they do. And the neo-racists are going to disagree with that too. You're going to find that Ibram Kendi writes in his book, there is only one race, the human race, is a sentiment that has failed in the past. It's not up to the task of fighting racism. It's characterized as a microaggression in one of the University of California's documents from 2015, I believe. And so, in my view, they are similar in that they do both deny that emphasizing common humanity is the proper approach to the question of race. Whereas the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King could not have been more explicit that, look, there are cultural differences between people, right? But it's actually more important from the point of view of political rhetoric, from the point of view of living together, that we choose to emphasize what we have in common more than what divides us. That what we choose to emphasize is always a choice, right? Like you can zero in on one fact or you can zero in on a contrary fact. And so the general idea is that to fight racism, how do we educate our kids? How do we talk about race in general? Is we ought to, in general, emphasize what people have in common.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub, with a special announcement. Over the coming weeks on our publishing platform, including this podcast feed, we are going to be bringing attention to the growing government subsidization of news journalism in Canada. It will be possible this year for many digital news outlets to access government funding for up to 50% of the salaries of their journalists. We think this is a problem. Public trust in the media is already at all-time lows. More government subsidies doesn't make this any better. In fact, government subsidies raise questions, legitimate ones, for listeners and news consumers like you. Can you trust news organizations that are taking large government supports to underwrite the cost of their journalism? Will they hold the powerful, including government, to account? Here at The Hub, we do not take government funding. We made this decision because we think it's important to our independence, to our credibility with you, our listeners and readers. Creating news and original content is expensive, time-consuming, and depends on people like you becoming paid subscribers. You can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.ca. Thank you in advance for your generous support. Now let's get back to our program.
As you mentioned earlier, the book argues that racial identity is a bad proxy for disadvantage, that class is actually a better one. I'm, of course, inclined to agree, but let's steel man your critics' view. They'd argue that there's actually a causal relationship here. That is to say, a Black person is disproportionately poor because his or her race subjects them to racist forces within our society or within educational or work environment. Abraham Kendi has famously said, as you cite in the book a couple of times, quote, "When I see racial disparities, I see racism," unquote. Why, Coleman, is that wrong?
So I would argue, even if it were true, it would not actually address the claim that class is a better proxy for disadvantage, right? Because if you're talking about a Black person who is poor, and you're trying to essentially pick out the set of people who are disadvantaged as a result of racism, let's just concede it for the sake of argument, still looking at their class is a better proxy, right? Let's say you have a brother and a sister from the same family. One made it into the upper middle class and one stayed in the ghetto. Well, they're both Black. If you're a policymaker and you want to pick out the set of people that need help, that need aid, what's a better proxy? Looking at for Black people as a set or looking for poor people as a set? Well, in that case, it's going to be looking at class. You're going to pick out the brother who's still in the ghetto and the sister who made it to Yale doesn't actually need your help. So I would argue it's not really making contact with my point, even if I agreed with it.
What about the argument that colorblindness may be a long-term goal, but that public policy ought to preference Blacks to overcome past cases of legalized racism, including slavery, segregation, and so on? That is to say, it's unfair to now pursue neutrality after a history of non-neutrality. What would be your response to that line of argument?
I think that would have been pretty compelling to me if I were alive in like 1965. If someone said to me, okay, we're going to do race-based affirmative action for a limited time period as a way of compensating Black Americans who have for hundreds of years been legally discriminated against. That would have been a more compelling argument 50 years ago than it would have than it is to me today. I would argue at some point you have to just agree and enshrine that we have a colorblind system starting now, because what happens is if you continue to discriminate, if you reverse discriminate, you create new groups of people who have now been discriminated against, right? Whether they're willing to complain about it publicly or not, and you create a never ending cycle of grievances. So at some point you have to get you have to get to a legal regime that does not take people's race into account in the vast majority of cases. I think that in practice, most of the people who argue, okay, we'll get to colorblindness at some point, but not yet, almost to a one, they will never recognize the point when we've gotten there. So And I don't think they necessarily mean to do this, but there is no arrangement of the world that is plausible where they would recognize it and say, okay, here we go. Now we get to colorblindness. That never actually happens.
One of the more interesting parts of the book is when you challenge neo-racist myths, including about the distribution of power in American society. You argue that, well, on balance, white Americans may have more economic power, Black Americans have more cultural power. What's your argument here, and why is it relevant to the book's overall thesis?
Yeah, so I guess there's two separate arguments. One is actually discussing how much power various groups have viewed as groups. And I think reasonable people could disagree on that. One of my arguments to that end is that Black people actually have a lot of cultural power in America. For instance, one measure of cultural power is whether you can enforce your group's taboos and values on everyone. So for example, I give the example in the book, Mormons cannot stop people from making fun of Mormons. They can't stop the Book of Mormon from running day after day, week after week, and everyone going and just laughing at their most sacred values, right? If they wanted to stop it, they could not. Black Americans have been very successful in getting people to stop doing things that offend a significant portion of us. No one can do blackface anymore, right? No matter what the intention. No one can say the N-word anymore, even not wielding it, not throwing it at someone, but actually quoting it, They can't say a sentence saying the N-word is a terrible word, you can never say it. They can't actually say the word even in that sentence. That's a big manifestation of cultural power if you can enforce the taboos that your group wants to see on everyone successfully. So that's one line of argument I make in the book. Another line of argument, which may even be more important, is that I'm not really sure this idea of, let's concede white people have more financial economic power. What does that actually mean for the tens of millions of white Americans who are living under the poverty line? If you're a poor white American, what good does it do you that there are people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos? How does that actually help you? It's not clear to me that it does. And so we don't live our lives as averages. You never meet the average man walking down the street. You meet particular individuals. And so I think it's a pretty big political problem to be thinking in terms of group power.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation the importance of choosing what to emphasize. You write in the book that in your mind, quote, racist talk makes racial thought, unquote. That is to say, the salience of racial discourse can actually contribute to racism itself, and that we ought to aspire to the goal of lowering the salience of race. What's behind your hypothesis here, and how can we go about reducing the salience of race?
This is more of a hypothesis than a definitive claim, but I think it's very possible that by making people think about race more, rather than decrease the amount of racism in the world, you might increase it. And I give an analogy where, let's say, for whatever reason, we wanted to decrease the level of hatred between Yankees fans and Red Sox fans, because this is, I don't know to what extent Canadian audience will understand that, but it's a very, you'll probably get it. It's a very hard thing to do. And we say, in order to do this, we're going to raise kids from day one to be obsessed with baseball. We're going to really educate them about baseball. And in this way, we're going to lessen the hatred between Yankees fans and Red Sox fans. Every child will know the rules of the game. Every gym class, instead of being dodgeball, every gym class will be baseball from kindergarten on upwards. Not at all obvious to me that this would lessen the hatred between Yankees fans and Red Sox fans. If anything, it would probably, the more people cared about baseball in general, probably the more attachment they would have to their home teams. At least it's possible. Okay, so is something like that possible in the case of race? If you raise kids from day one to think that their race is extremely important, their whiteness is something they have to meditate on from a very early age, their blackness is something they have to meditate on, it's a meaningful fact about them. Will this lessen the tensions between different races of people, or will it amplify them? Well, it seems to me very possible, maybe even likely, that it will amplify those.
As we've discussed a bit already, a key insight in the book is that one approach to address some of the issues that we've been talking about is to replace today's race-based policies with more class-based policies. As I read that part of the book, Coleman, it prompted the question for me, why do you think the left has generally abandoned class in favor of these other identities?
It's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is that you have a lot of elites, which I would count myself among that world, absolutely. Upper middle class elites of different races who don't really benefit from class-based politics because, almost all of the people of color who go to Ivy League schools and get, impressive jobs, almost all of us are on the wrong side of class warfare. you know, we're in the wrong tax bracket to be complaining about class warfare and pushing class politics. We are the oppressor in that context. And so it makes a lot more sense strategically to adopt race-based politics if you're one of the races that are sort of the good guys in this philosophy. That is to say, if you are Black, if you're Hispanic, to some extent, if you're Asian, at least in certain contexts, it makes a lot more sense, because then you are in the virtuous class that is railing against the white oppressor class, as opposed to in a class politics, you are in the bourgeoisie, and you're the one that, you know, needs to get liquidated.
You've faced some tough questions, including this week on The View, about making these arguments as a Black man yourself. What social pressure or tension do you feel advancing the case for colorblindness? And how optimistic are you in terms of people being responsive to your ideas?
I guess I have a mix of very different signals in life. I grew up in blue America. I think I knew exactly one Republican growing up, and I still know very few Republicans, frankly, like in my actual day-to-day social life and family life. And so most of the social pressures in my life have been in the direction of not arguing for the things I'm arguing for. On the other hand, I think there is a quiet plurality or maybe even majority of Democrat voters that strongly resonate with what I say, or just view it as kind of obvious common sense, almost boring. And so that's another signal I get. And then, you know, I get this, the signal from people like Sonny Hostin on The View that I'm a sellout, I'm an Uncle Tom, so on and so forth. No evidence ever really provided for these claims, just as you can see what happened on The View. Often people make themselves look bad by throwing those kind of labels without any evidence. I mean, for example, if I was backed by a shadowy Koch brothers, you know, situation where, you know, that would be some kind of evidence in theory for why I'm saying what I'm saying. It would still be ad hominem, strictly speaking, but I'm, you know, I have an independent podcast, I have a Substack, I work at CNN, and I'm an analyst for CNN and a writer for the Free Press, but I'm independent in all those endeavors. And so I don't think there's anywhere for that kind of critique to land, even though people make it.
Let me just say on behalf of Pub listeners that you certainly handled yourself extraordinarily well in that circumstance. And as you say, your critics came off looking much, much, much worse. Let me put a penultimate question to you. You're someone who's thought and written a lot about issues of culture and race and public policy within an American context. How much attention or thought have you given to the extent to which the American discussion spills outside its borders and comes to influence discourse on issues of culture, race, and public policy in other parts of the world?
Yeah, it seems enormous. It seems that we have an enormous influence, in particular on the English-speaking world. We export music, we export culture, and we export kind of not policy per se, but like kind of political modes, political folkways. And we've exported, I think, wokeness certainly to Canada, to the UK, to Australia. And it always inflects a little bit. It gets refracted through the particular politics of the country. So in Canada, the indigenous issue is much bigger than in America. For many reasons. In the UK, there's, you know, differences in an inflection. In Australia, the indigenous issue is much bigger as well. But America is still enormously culturally influential, and I think people take their cues from America in some way. I'm curious if you share that impression, because I don't want to sound overly self-important as an American, but I think it is a fact that we export an enormous amount of culture.
It's precisely why I put the question to you. It feels in a lot of ways, Coleman, like within Canada, we are some number of years behind you, but we are having a lot of the same debates, even though a lot of the contextual factors that underpin the American debate don't fit neatly within the Canadian context. We have a relatively small Black population. We didn't have slavery or segregation. And yet you're starting to see the manifestation of race-based policies targeting our Black population. And then, as you mentioned, obviously these ideas are influencing the way we think and talk about our Indigenous population and its relationship to the broader society. And so I think your characterization of American influence across the English-speaking world, for better or for worse, is accurate. Which leads me to my final question, talking about the intersection between your work and Canada. You cite a friend of Hub Dialogues, Jamil Givani, in the book's acknowledgement. Jamil, as many listeners will probably know, will soon be sworn in as a member of Canada's parliament. Why did you acknowledge him? And what do you think someone like him can contribute to these conversations as a legislator?
Yeah, well, I've had some really good conversations with Jamil over the years, one of which was on my podcast, Conversations with Coleman. I think one of the early episodes I had Jamil on. And he's someone I've always admired. And his approach to not only to the issue of race is pretty similar to mine. His approach to the way he thinks about his own life, having come from a situation of disadvantage, understanding what it is to be born into a situation where you can go either way. You know, he had a situation where, you know, he was pretty close to kind of criminal elements in his social life and could have gone that way, but ended up staking out a different path for himself. And I find that to be a very important perspective as well, to understand how to speak to the people that are on the margins of society, to understand the real challenges that they face rather than the kind of imagined challenges that they face. And so I wish him very well in his, you know, burgeoning political career.
It's a great way to wrap up what's been an insightful conversation. The book is The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Coleman Hughes, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. Thehub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Spear. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, the Hub's editor at large. This episode was produced by Amal Atter-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.